to fight. Some of the members were sent to the Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon to receive military training. But before they were able to begin an armed assault, the Iranian intelligence service, known as the SAVAK, were tipped off to their plans. And in the spring of 1972, all the core members of the group, except one, were executed. Mas'ud Rajavi had his life spared in light of cooperating with the SAVAK. Instead, he was sentenced to life imprisonment. Rajavi was a skilled and compelling orator. This ability allowed him to gain a number of followers in prison. When Rajavi and his comrades were in prison, other members of the MEK killed several American officers through a number of terrorist attacks and officially declared themselves as a communist organization. The resulting international outcry in response to the attacks caused its members to be either detained, killed, or forced into hiding. This left the group to remain in name only. On February 11, 1979, the Iranian Revolution was successful in ousting the Shah's regime. A month earlier, Rajavi and several other political prisoners were released from jail. Rajavi saw the newly successful revolution as an opportunity to achieve power. But this idea could only be realized through resurrecting the MEK. Consequently, the MEK's governing council was established with Rajavi as its head. But the group needed to prove their revolutionary credentials so as to attract more members. Hence, they took ownership of the terrorist acts that were carried out, but they rejected those who claimed to be communists as members of the organization. Using the chaos of the early days of the revolution, the group occupied various properties and through that acquired significant funds. They were also successful in seizing a sizable number of arms from the army and police buildings, all in the name of defending the budding revolution. The members of the MEK believed that they were pioneers of the revolution in Iran and that Rajavi's leadership gave their organization new life. New members of the organization viewed Rajavi as the sole remnant of the first generation of its leaders. Older members viewed him as the savior of the MEK. All viewed him as a leader who would guarantee their victory in the upcoming elections. But in the elections for the Council of Constitutional Experts and the Parliament, the organization as a whole met with bitter political defeats. Worst of all, Rajavi himself was not able to gain enough votes to win a seat. Rajavi now had to find another way to gain power in Iran. The president of Iran at the time was at odds with the Republican Party, the same group that dealt Rajavi an electoral defeat. This common political foe drew the two individuals closer together. This new political alliance did not bear any fruit, as the parliament soon voted to impeach the president, crushing Rajavi's hopes for power yet again. Rajavi chose a different strategy to deal with his political opponents. A week later, an explosion destroyed the Republican Party headquarters. 70 of its members, along with the party leader, were killed, removing this party from the political landscape. Contrary to Rajavi's calculations, the attack led to great sympathy for the deceased. A month after the attack, Rajavi fled the country in secret and gave the order to assassinate political leaders in Iran. He assumed armed struggle to be the only way to achieve power. On August 30th, 1981, the Prime Minister and President of Iran were killed by a bomb placed in their office. The attack did not yield the result Rajavi was looking for and only made his organization more hated. Rajavi now tried a more drastic strategy. He ordered the killing of all pro-government civilians. No exceptions were made. As a result of the organization's armed struggle, its members were pursued and arrested. Seeing his organization facing extinction, Rajavi ordered its members to flee Iran for Iraq, and this while the war between Saddam and Iran was ongoing. Henceforth, Iraq became a safe haven for the organization. Toppling Iran's government was the common goal for Saddam and Rajavi. This common goal resulted in 7,000 men and women from the MEK to serve in Saddam's army. Among their tasks was to function as spies and interrogate Iranian POWs. In Iraq, with the excuse of wartime conditions, Rajavi instituted a new set of rules for the organization. He banned the use of telephones, newspapers, television, and radio for all members. As a result, members of the organization were cut off from all forms of outside communication and only received information Rajavi had tailored for them. In late 1984, news of Rajavi's affair with the wife of one of his associates became a problematic issue for the organization. On February 28, 1985, Rajavi ordered his associate to divorce his wife, Mariam, so that he could marry her himself. His command went unopposed by the associate, who claimed opposing Rajavi's path is worse than opposing the path of God. Rajavi called his marriage to Mariam an ideological revolution, and the couple together became the leadership for the organization. Around this time, Saddam had constructed a barracks for the organization, which would serve as its headquarters. With funding and supplies from Saddam's Ba'athist government, Rajavi began organizing his own army. The ceasefire between Iran and Iraq after 8 years of war resulted in another defeat for Rajavi in his quest for power. Rajavi then decided to make use of his private army to attack Iran. He had convinced members of the MEK that the people of Iran were awaiting their arrival and they would reach Tehran within 48 hours. On Monday, July 25th, 1988, Rajavi ordered his troops to commence the attack. Contrary to his claims, the Iranian people did not embrace his army's arrival. After 3 days, and the loss of 3,000 of its soldiers, his army retreated back to Iraq. This defeat caused members in the organization to doubt the Rajavi's leadership. To absolve himself from responsibility, he announced that the reason for the organization's defeat was due to sexual deviation within the ranks of his army. He instituted a new law for MEK members. All married couples were to divorce. Maryam Rajavi, in supporting him, said that the hearts of the organization's members must only be dedicated to the leadership of the organization. The presence of children in the camp made this new law hard to enforce. America's attack on Iraq and the start of the Persian Gulf War provided Rajavi a solution. Under the pretext of protecting them from the dangers of war, the children were sent to camps in Germany and the Netherlands. Rajavi calculated that this would prevent the organization's members from getting distracted in carrying out the goals he and his wife had set for them. The Kurdish and Shia resistance to Saddam coincided with the attack by the American coalition. Rajavi, seeing the pressure on his ally Saddam mounting, sprung into action and ordered attacks to be carried out against the Kurds. Maryam Rajavi commanded the operation. This joint operation by the MEK and Saddam's army was successful and resulted in the killing of hundreds of thousands of people, much to the delight of Saddam. The killing of their Iraqi hosts did not sit well with a number of the organization's members. To quell the skepticism, Rajavi instituted a new law, self-criticism. Members were required to announce their most intimate thoughts in front of others. Months later, Maryam unveiled the next plan of the organization. High-ranking female members of the MEK were taken to her husband so they could achieve what she called oneness with him. In addition to this, Rajavi had all of the males removed from the organization's leadership council and established a new, female-only one in its place. Maryam Rajavi was placed at the head of this council. Opponents to this move were labeled as gender-biased and suppressed. In what was known as the security check, the opponents to this move were accused of spying for Iran, were tortured, and sent to Abu Ghraib prison. Some of them did not survive. Rajavi assumed that the people in Iran were under pressure and could not choose their own president. And so he chose his wife Maryam to be Iran's president and gave her the title the Shining Sun. But the widespread participation of the Iranian public in the subsequent presidential elections contradicted Rajavi's analysis of the situation in the country. To generate morale for his followers, he ordered terrorist attacks in Iran. The MEK launched several mortars indiscriminately that were met with international condemnation, putting the group under pressure. In 2003, on the verge of America's invasion of Iraq, in fear that his followers would take advantage of this opportunity to desert him, Rajavi announced that if they tried to escape, they would be killed by Iranian authorities. To further assure himself, he ordered his followers to destroy all personal belongings and eliminate any connections to their previous lives. With the American invasion of Iraq, Mas'ud and Maryam Rajavi fled from Iraq and found refuge in Europe. They ordered the remaining leadership of the MEK to open negotiations with the Americans and to ensure the Americans that they would cooperate. The MEK was considered a terrorist organization by the American government due to the attacks they had previously carried out. Rajavi's promises to combat the Iranian government and his lobbying certain American officials won the group the ability to remain in Iraq on the condition that they would disarm. January 17, 2003, Mariam Rajavi and a number of members of her female entourage were arrested by French police for attempting to murder 25 ex-members of the organization. In order to avoid conviction in French courts, Mariam ordered members of the organization to burn themselves alive in front of police stations and public locations in France. The move put pressure on the French government, and as a result, Mariam was released. In the following years, the members of the organization that had remained in Iraq faced a big problem. The people of Iraq no longer wanted them in the country. America and European countries would not accept them either. Hence, America and the EU removed the MEK from the list of terrorist organizations in order to ease the relocation of its members as asylum-seeking refugees. Masoud Rajavi handed the leadership of the organization to Mariam and thereafter disappeared from the public eye. Now, the question is, which country is prepared to accept the MEK? On March 18, 2013, the Albanian government accepted 210 refugees who had lived in Iraq for years. 210 men and women who were non-Iraqi and were all transferred from a camp in Baghdad to Albania.
After steady progress over a period of months, I visited Tirana earlier this year, and I discussed with the Albanian government how to assist in facilitating the transfer and the resettlement of the last group of MEK members from Camp Liberty.
In 2016, the American government was able to convince the government of Albania to accept the remaining members of the MEK. Tirana became the new camp for members of the MEK, a camp in the heart of Europe. The inhabitants of this camp, based on the orders of Mariam, have laid down their weapons. They are patiently waiting for their next mission. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Since the start of the Christian New Year 2023, European cities have been the scene of protests and strikes against their governments. This time, the Spanish capital city witnessed a huge anti-government protest. Reports say thousands of Spanish people protested in Madrid on Saturday, January 21st, against Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez's government. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Reuters, thousands of people packed into central Madrid on Saturday, January 21st, to protest against the socialist government and accuse it of undermining the constitution. In a rally backed by rightist parties, protesters massed in the Plaza dos Cibeles in front of City Hall, waved Spanish flags, called on Prime Minister Pedro Sánchez to resign, and shouted out, "Traitor!" More than 100 groups, including the conservative opposition Popular Party, center-right Ciudadanos, and the far-right Vox, called the rally under the slogan, "For Spain, for Democracy and the Constitution." Speakers attacked the government for a string of policies and decisions, ranging from the release of Catalan independence campaigners to its pact with regional separatist parties. Around 30,000 people took part, according to local government estimates. Vox leader Santiago Abascal, the only party leader to attend, told the crowd the government had trampled the constitution by locking up Spaniards, in a reference to COVID lockdowns. Around 200 kilometers away in the northwestern city of Valladolid, Sanchez told the socialist rally that the protesters in Madrid were defending a uniform and therefore discriminatory Spain. In June 2021, Sánchez's government pardoned the 9 jailed leaders of Catalonia's failed 2017 independence bid in the spirit of dialogue. Its recent decision to replace the crime of sedition with a lesser crime was opposed on the right. France 24 also wrote in this regard, participants in the recent protest waved red and yellow Spanish flags and called on Sánchez to resign. Some held up signs with a photo of the socialist premier calling him a traitor. Around 30,000 people gathered in Madrid's Cibeles Square for the rally, according to the central government's delegation in the Spanish capital. Organizers said some 700,000 people had taken part. The protest was called by dozens of right-leaning civil society groups and backed by conservative parties, including the main opposition Conservative Popular Party and Vox. The right is angered by the government's decision to abolish the crime of sedition, of which 9 separatist leaders were convicted over their role in the Catalonia region's abortive session in 2017. It was replaced with an offense carrying a lower prison sentence. Conservatives are also angered by a flagship law against sexual violence that toughened penalties for rape but eased sentences for other sexual crimes. Speaking to reporters at the start of the rally, Vox leader Santiago Abascal denounced the worst government in the history of Spain, which has divided Spaniards and freed rapists and coup leaders. PP leader Alberto Núñez Feijóo, who has tried to push the party to the center since becoming its leader in April, was not at the rally but encouraged members for the formation to attend. Most polls suggest the PP would win a general election expected at the end of the year, but would need the support of Vox to govern. Before that, Spain will vote in May in regional and local elections. Lacking a parliamentary majority, Sanchez's government has been forced since its formation to negotiate with Basque and Catalan separatists to pass bills, which has angered many on the right. Conservatives accuse Sanchez of having eliminated the crime of sedition to assure the continued support of Catalan pro-independence party ERC in tight parliamentary votes. But the government argues sedition is an antiquated offense that needed to be replaced with one better aligned to European norms. Anadolu agency also wrote in this regard, tens of thousands take to Madrid streets in anti-government protest. Right-wing forces accuse Prime Minister of supporting terrorists and separatists. Tens of thousands of people participated in an anti-government protest in Madrid calling for the resignation of the Prime Minister. Government authorities said around 31,000 people participated, while organizers estimated a much higher turnout of 500,000 people. Spain is currently run by a minority coalition government, which has sought support from regional political groups in Catalonia and the Basque country to pass legislation. Meanwhile, speaking from a Socialist Party rally in Valladolid, Sanchez compared the recent protest to the one staged in Barcelona by Catalan separatists, calling both groups nostalgic and exclusionary. Between the protest in Barcelona and the protest in Madrid, you'll find the vast majority of Spaniards who want a united, respectful, and diverse country, he said, pointing out that under his leadership, the Catalan political crisis has faded.
Hidden Files.
Being punished for the original sin, and that is beating white supremacy colonialism. That is how some experts describe what has happened and continues to happen to a small but significant nation in the Caribbean, Haiti. Slavery in Haiti began after the arrival of Christopher Columbus on the island in 1492 with European colonists that followed from Portugal, Spain, and France. In the late 18th century and early 19th century, in Saint-Domingue, as Haiti was once called, the French had enslaved 500,000 Africans there. Well, the slaves would harvest coffee, sugarcane, and work the cotton fields and serve the Europeans in whatever ways the colonialists deemed necessary. This island became France's most lucrative possession. Ultimately, the slaves who were treated terribly started revolting against the French. Now, this movement ultimately led to their victory over the imperialist colonialists, and Haiti became the only country in the world where former slaves succeeded in overthrowing their enslavers and establishing their own country. These Africans were able to beat one of the best militaries at the time that was led by Napoleon. He sent 50,000 French troops to the island, but ultimately France and their European and American supporters lost. This is the original sin that Africans were successful in beating European colonizers, and some analysts say the American-European front has never forgiven Haiti for winning and for being black. Hello and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Haiti set an example when it declared its independence in 1804. It became the first country in the world to permanently outlaw slavery and ban imperial rule during a time when slavery was the norm in many countries. Haiti was the symbol of freedom. Haiti broke the common rule of the day that liberty and equality were for white men only. Haiti said that no human beings should ever be enslaved. It sounds very enlightening, but that is not how the French, the Americans, and others saw it. Leaders wanted to do whatever they could in order for Haiti not to succeed, and those who revolted in Haiti wanted to do whatever they could in order for the revolution to succeed.
U.S. President Thomas Jefferson was worried that the revolution in Haiti could ignite a slave revolt in the United States, and he would do his best not to help Haiti's southern slaveholders, who were very fearful that this could spread and encourage U.S. politicians to overthrow the new country. Napoleon Bonaparte, French military leader at the time, wrote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever the forward march of blacks in the world." After Haiti had routed the French and its allies, the first leader of Haiti, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, said about the victory, "These impeccable enemies of the rights of man have been punished for their crimes. Yes, we have paid these true cannibals back, crime for crime, war for war, outrage for outrage. I have saved my country. I have avenged America."
Well, when listening to the story of Haiti, it sounds like a part of history that took place a long time ago in the past. But the reality is that as we bring you this program today, the Haitian people are on the streets and have been for months. The people are demanding an end to foreign intervention and the theft of their wealth. They want the United Nations not to interfere, and they want these Western and so-called international entities to stop impoverishing Haiti and to stop trying to enslave this nation once again. Well, to help me look at this further, I'd like to turn to our guest, Dr. Jemima Pierre.
Dr. Jemima Pierre is a professor of African American Studies and Anthropology. Currently, she teaches at the University of California in Los Angeles, UCLA. She is the coordinator of the Haiti Americas team, Black Alliance for Peace, and editor and contributor for the Black Agenda Report.
Well, Dr. Pierre, thanks so much for being with us here at Hidden Files. Whenever we hear anything about Haiti, it is always negative and the country's demonized. In your perspective, why is that the case?
Well, I mean, you know, there's a great quote by the African-American abolitionist, Frederick Douglass, who says that Haiti has never been forgiven for winning the revolution against slavery and colonialism. And so we have to start there. We have to start thinking about it's 200 and some years of constant demonization, constant move to suppress Haitian self-determination. And so from the very beginning, so people should know that, for example, you know, Haiti became independent in 1804. The U.S. and the West did not really recognize Haitian independence until 1865. It's been hard going ever since then, trying to maintain sovereignty and independence. And the West, I think, really has this really deep hatred for that history because it did upend the entire system of slavery and colonization in the New World.
Well, I mean, what would you say to some people that, you know, that happened over 200 years ago? Why would they still try to punish Haiti today?
Well, it is interesting, right, to say that for a country that is so small, and for a country that seems insignificant, the U.S. really spends a lot of time and money trying to control it. And so we have to think about, for example, the fact that even after independence, what you had was constant affronts by the French, by the British, but by the U.S. So the U.S. occupied Haiti from 1915 to 1934, which is one of the longest occupations in the region. Very brutal. In fact, the U.S. Practiced its first aerial bombing campaigns in Haiti during that occupation. The U.S. has the fourth largest embassy in Haiti. So you're saying, well, if Haiti's so inconsequential, why does it have the fourth largest embassy? Why in 2003 did France, U.S., and Canada meet in Ottawa? Your listeners can look up the Ottawa Initiative. Met in Ottawa, basically coming up with a plan to remove the democratically elected president of Haiti, which plan succeeded in February 2004, the year of the 200th anniversary of the Haitian independence. And so there's a lot of history that demonstrates that there's this really deep deep set of feelings among the Europeans for Haiti. And the way that Haiti is demonized and talked about in the news, the way that things are sensationalized. And so, you know, we in the U.S., where I am currently living, we have mass shootings every day. You know, the schools are in lockdown. This is a very violent country, but it doesn't get represented in the same way that Haiti does if we have a set of protesters. So there's a built-up history of representations of Haiti that allow the world to actually believe that these black people are savages that cannot run themselves. And, you know, the one quote that I wanted to show is, you know, Napoleon, whose army, which at the time was the most powerful army in the day, was defeated by the Haitians. And he wrote, and I have this quote, "My decision to destroy the authority of the blacks in Saint-Domingue," which is what Haiti was called, "is not so much based on considerations of commerce and money as on the need to block forever forward the march of the blacks of the world, in the world." And so if you start with that quote, what does that tell you about the feelings towards Haiti? And I think if you see that and then you see all the WikiLeaks files which were released and you see the machinations behind U.S. policy in Haiti, then everything comes clear to us. In the Security Council meetings, everyone was saying we need an intervention because there's gang violence. And so then you had the representatives from Albania, of all places, which is like at the edge of Europe and going through its own problems. It's going to have its own security, energy crisis in a couple of months. And then you have Ireland, which barely independent, and you have Kenya. And all these people are calling for intervention because they're saying we need to deal with gang violence. What's interesting is that what doesn't come up, especially for the Latin American countries, is that Haiti is under occupation, right? And that's what I want the world to know. In 2004, when the U.S.-led coup d'etat that removed the president, put him on a plane, the U.S. Marines landed in his house, put him on a plane and flew him to Africa into exile, of all places. And then the U.S. sent the military. U.S., Canada, and France had military folks already on the ground within hours of this removal. And then they were able to get the UN to cover up this by sending in a Chapter 7 deployment of UN peacekeeping. And what you have then is you have this brutal force that was there, you know, with hundreds of thousands of soldiers, a whole apparatus. The way they were able to hide this occupation, because they were able to get a multiracial, multinational force, UN forces, to say that they're stabilizing Haiti. Haiti was not at war, so a Chapter 7 deployment means that they could use force. And the UN, which we call the occupation forces, killed thousands of people. They brought cholera into the country that killed 30,000 people because they dumped feces, you know, fecal matter in Haiti, the main water source in central Haiti. It sickened a million people, killed more than 30,000 people. The UN, it took them 6 years to at least acknowledge that it was their fault. And so you have that, but under this occupation, you had the construction of what they call the core group. And this core group was founded in 2004, right when the UN Security Council resolution said that the force was coming. And the core group the membership is fluctuated, but it has members from Brazil, Canada, France, Germany, Spain, the U.S., the European Union, the Organization of American States, and they basically coordinate the various branches of the United Nations occupation of Haiti. The core group still runs Haiti.
Wow, it's really something unbelievable. I mean, if we look back at 2003 that you just talked about, with the election of the Haitian president, President Aristide, and he demanded France, after he was elected, to repay Haiti $21 billion in reparations. Now, he was removed in a Western-backed coup the next year, as you had just talked about. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the Haitian president demanding reparation and his him basically being overthrown?
Oh, definitely. You know, he said that, and I think it really riled up the French, the Canadians, and the Americans, and the French in particular. And the French have a really terrible colonial role. I mean, look what they did in, you know, in Libya and Algeria, and all over West Africa till this day, right? They're stealing all their resources and so on. But that was really, you know, he made that speech the year before in 2003. And by the end of 2003, you have France, Canada, and the U.S. meeting in Ottawa coming up with a plan. And one of the first things they did were when they removed him, and I actually have an article that is called The Archive of Occupation, which lays out minute day by day how this coup d'etat happened from 2000, you know, from all of early 2004. And what you see is as soon as they find this guy that they bring in and they make him, you know, interim prime minister. So they remove Aristide, they bring him. And the first thing he does was remove the petition, the request for the reparations, right? So that was one of the first acts. And so that tells me there's definitely a direct connection. And I think, you know, ever since then, you know, people have picked up on that. So for example, the New York Times had a whole story on reparations, but what's not included in that story is the fact that Haiti's under current occupation now. And people want to forget that there's an occupation going, that there's no sovereignty in the country. But I do think it's very much linked to the request for this payment back, that you have this coup d'etat. I mean, to be fair, not to be fair, but Aristide was already, that was the second coup against Aristide. The CIA was behind a coup of Aristide in 1991, 9 months after he was elected by landslide, after we had 30 years of a U.S.-supported dictatorship. And so they've been after him, but this particular time, I think this played a big role in having him removed.
Well, stay with us, Dr. Pierre. You have a lot of information. I'll be back right after this with you.
A country with 10 million people, which shares the island with the Dominican Republic. Haiti is a country which has never been forgiven by Western imperialists for its revolution in 1803, where slaves beat them all and declared its independence. It took France until 1825 to recognize Haiti's independence, and this came only after Paris sent 12 warships and threatened Haiti to repay France for its lost revenue and property, meaning the slaves and their labor. Up until that time, no country would trade with Haiti. The French demanded the astronomical amount of 150 million gold francs. It took Haiti until 1947 to pay this crippling debt. This prevented Haiti from having funds to invest in its own country. Because of financial pressure to pay France, Haiti got a loan from the United States. In 1914, the U.S. sent soldiers to collect what they called the debt, invaded Haiti, and went directly to Haiti's national bank and walked out with $500,000 in gold, packed in wooden boxes. The gold was in the vault of a Wall Street bank within days. The U.S. then occupied Haiti for 19 years and left in name in 1934. Since that time, there has been coups, assassinations, and interference by Western governments, as well as international organizations. In 2003, the president of Haiti at the time, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, demanded that France repay Haiti for the gold francs that Paris had extorted from the country. He said that amount would now come to $21 billion. The following year, Aristide was overthrown in a coup and flown to the Central African Republic by the Americans. After the coup, the United Nations sent in troops who would remain there for 13 years, leaving a legacy of death via cholera and insecurity. 2021, President Jovenel Moïse is assassinated. 2022, currently Haiti is not being run by an elected president, but a group picked by the international community, who many would say prioritize the needs of Western countries and corporations, not the Haitian people. Currently, Haitians are on the street, and the IMF is trying to force the government to take away gasoline subsidies that would pressure the people even more.
Well, let's get back to our guest, Dr. Pierre, now. Dr. Pierre, give me a little short history of the damage you feel that's been done to Haiti by colonialism and the colonialists.
To win this independence, Haiti had to fight against the French, the Spanish, the British, the Americans. It's like they were all helping each other. And so if you ever visit Citadel in Haiti, where, you know, it's built at the top, you can see all the cannons that they had that acquired from the various European forces that were fighting them. And so that tells you that from the very beginning. But the other part is, it is, you know, the French, of course, you know, it's the gold franc that it took, which really impoverished the country, because then in order, and the leader at the time felt that he needed to do that in order to get recognition, right? This was a country that had to fight a scorched earth war against this superpower, and they were enslaved Africans with no weapons, right? And they were able to win. And so by the end of this, there's nothing left, you know, on the ground, and they have to start from scratch. But no one would no other nation would recognize them, right, for a long time. And so this president thought that maybe, you know, if they go ahead and pay France, that they would get the recognition so that you can have trade and so on and so forth. But then in paying that, it just meant that you're impoverishing the country, because, you know, it got so bad, and then they had to get a loan from the U.S. to pay off the French. And so they didn't finish paying that till very recently, right? So you can see what this means in terms of paying a debt for your own freedom, right? The paying the European, paying your former enslavers money because you dare be free. The U.S. is very much implicated in this. And I do think the Europeans work together. And so I call it, like, you know, pan-European, like, white supremacy, because they do work together. But the U.S., you know, the first thing with the French is the image of Haiti that emerges out of this period, right? So you have a brutal uprising, but they're representing it in the media, in the Western media in the 1800s, as these savages are killing white landowners, raping white women. And so if you look at the images from the early 1800s, that's what you see of Haiti, that these are like violent savages that can't that can't really rule themselves. And that image has really followed us over the years. So even if it was like, you know, if there was a shooting and two people got killed, it becomes huge, as opposed to the mass shootings we have in the U.S. every day, right? It doesn't make the news. And part of that is already baked into the worldview, including other countries outside of Europe, because that's the images that they're fed.
What needs to happen, in your opinion, to turn the situation around in Haiti?
It is complex. And I do talk about this, that people think, oh, Haiti is so difficult, so complex, and we don't know what to do. It's actually not that complex. What Haitians want is the UN to get out of their country. The UN is not the UN is not a democratic institution. It has five core members that make all the decisions, and the five core members are mostly from the West. You know, they finally opened it up to China and Russia, but the UN is not a democratic institution, and we are under occupation. So the Haitian people want the U.S., the UN to get out. They want the U.S. to remove, take down this puppet prime minister that they put in place. That they don't want, because it's under this puppet prime minister that's allowing all of these things to happen. And I have to say, there's illegal mining going on in Haiti. These puppet governments have basically signed over all of Haiti's mineral resources, and the country's rich with mineral resources. There are oil companies drilling right on the outskirts of the island. And so we have to think about the fact that if Haiti is so poor, Why is it that every day there are like four flights from Miami, Florida to Haiti filled with white businessmen going to Haiti to make money, right? So there's that. And so what Haitians want is to, they want this so-called, this prime minister that's implicated, by the way, in the assassination of the president, right? And the U.S. knows that, the U.S. has all the evidence. They want the prime minister to come down. They want the U.N. to leave Haiti. And they want the space for Haitian, they always say this, Haitian solution. And, you know, before Jovenel Moïse was the president that was assassinated, before he was assassinated in July, there are a bunch of groups that came together in February 2021. And, you know, it was like a coalition for, you know, coming up with a Haitian solution. And there are several groups. One is called the Montana Group that basically laid out a plan, a two-year plan for the transitional government, elections, and so on. Well, the U.S. refused to take heed, and not only did they refuse to take heed, they managed to actually, incorporate some of these individuals, right? Managed to get them so that they could basically follow through. And then try to gain favor with the U.S. And so then that basically just took out all the active radical elements from the group, and basically the group just was destroyed. And so now the U.S. is talking about a Haitian solution, but it has handpicked those who are supposed to come up with a Haitian solution. So what we need is to be left alone. These people need to leave us alone. They need to leave the country, leave us alone, and we will figure it out. And we're not even being allowed to do that. They won't leave. You know, they won't leave the country. They won't stop, you know, intervening. And until they do, it's going to be a mess. And I think at this point, Haitians have had it. And I think they're willing to continue protesting. And I have to also say, these current protests have been going on for 6 weeks, but you would never know that, right? Because you would never know that they've been protesting, asking the UN to leave.
Wow, really interesting. Dr. Pierre, do you have any final comments?
Well, I just want to say I hope people will take the time and understand the situation is not an exceptional situation in the sense that Haiti is so different from the rest of us, the rest of the world who are suffering from Western imperialism. And so if we understand Haiti and Haitian people as real human beings, not just, you know, these people who won a revolution 200 years ago, real human beings with real needs and need to have access to their own sovereignty and their self-determination. I hope the rest of the world will join us in that fight against the Western imperialism that is really holding, you know, that is keeping us under their boot.
All right, and we hope the same thing. Thanks so much for being with us here on the program, Dr. Pierre. The story of Haiti is one of a country with so much potential, so many resources, but one which has been sabotaged. Many of its members of its upper class have worked in cahoots with Western governments to steal all they can and to create chaos on the island. The real story is the wealth that has been stolen that needs to be returned. This is another story of colonialists and imperialists being held responsible and made to repay what they've stolen, though they can never really repay it. It is estimated that currently France should repay at least $120 billion for the money that it extorted from Haiti. And then the United States should be held responsible for its theft and causing instability in Haiti. There are groups that are taking these demands for reparations to the international community, but will it make a difference? What we know is that the Haitian people are revolutionary and resilient, and we hope that while they are on the streets demanding justice, that this will ultimately lead to their real independence and empowerment. Well, like all of our other files we've mentioned, we will continue to follow up on Haiti, the affluent nation, which has been impoverished and demonized, with the hope that the Haitian people will ultimately get what they deserve. Until next time, I'm Marzia Hashemi for Hidden Files.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, brothers and sisters, dear listeners, welcome to Mafatihul Hayat, Keys of Life. I am your host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi. One of the keys of life that we've discussed before was health, and specifically when it comes to taking care of our bodies from the outside. Among the keys in this subject is the adequacy of ablution and going to the bathroom. When a person needs to go to the bathroom and performs tahara and purification, there are certain number of adequates we've been told by Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam that we need to observe. So obviously within limits and conditions. So let us see what the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam have to say in this regard. This is something that me and you need to apply, because we do go to the bathroom at least, you know, 5-6 times a day, depending on what conditions you have. But nevertheless, the bathroom is one of the places we constantly visit. Okay, so we need to understand, how should I approach the bathroom itself? What are the things that I can do, and what are the things that I should not do? All right, so let's keep that in mind. Now, the first thing is, we have a hadith from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, narrated to us by Al-Imam As-Sadiq alayhi as-salam. And he says, كان رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم أشد الناس توقيا للبول. He said the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi was the most cautious person when it comes to urine. Because we do understand that urine itself is a najis item, an item which we call impurity, which means if it falls on my clothes, if it falls on my body parts, it makes my body or my clothes najis, which means that I cannot perform certain types of worship. Like Salah, for example, it requires purity from all najasat. So if there is urine on my clothes or on my feet, I have to be very careful. If I don't purify it, then my salah goes out of the door. So the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam, when he goes to the bathroom, he is very cautious in terms of urine. Why? Because urine is a liquid. And usually when a person goes to urinate, that liquid sometimes, it comes with strength. It gushes out. So sometimes it just falls and just splashes around, which makes it, you know, very delicate dealing with. So the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, he used to be very careful that urine does not fall on him. And the hadith continues from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when he talks about the method of the Prophet. He says, كَرَاهِيَّةً أَنْ يَنْضَحَ عَلَيْهِ الْبَوْلِ. Why was he so cautious? Because he did not want the urine to fall and sprinkle on his clothes or on his body. So me and you, when we go to the bathroom, we have to be very careful not to make urine fall on our clothes. And like I said, one of the reasons being is the fact that we need tahara to be pure when it comes to salah, for example. And a lot of people, especially when they go outside and there are no places to urinate, and people urinate on the outside, sometimes it falls back, splashes back on the body. So we have to be very careful. Let us take a short break and then we will continue.
Ayatollah Javadi Omoli, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اینه که فرونت رخکاری اینجا کم سواب داره، دعا هم داره، سواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که این رو گفته دارم گفته دیگه اون امامش.